this is Danielle Fisher. Welcome to Melanoma Insights for Professionals, brought to you by Melanoma Institute Australia. In today's podcast, we're shining a spotlight on mucosal melanoma, a rare and aggressive form of melanoma that arises from the mucous membrane. Today, we'll be focusing our discussion on the head and neck mucosal region. Leading our discussion today is Associate Professor Sydney Chung. Sydney is a plastic and reconstructive surgeon and head and neck surgeon at MIA and the Chris O'Brien Lifehouse, and Associate Professor of Surgery at the University of Sydney. We also welcome Associate Professor Raewyn Campbell today. Raewyn is a rhinologist and anterior skull-based surgeon and an Associate Professor at Macquarie University. She's also the Vice President of the Australian and New Zealand Rhinologic Society. Professor Angela Hong is also in the studio today. Welcome, Angela. Angela is a radiation oncologist at MIA and a clinical professor at the University of Sydney. And joining them for the discussion is Dr. Rob Rawson. Rob is a pathologist at MIA and the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital. And lastly, we'd like to welcome Professor Georgina Long. Georgina is a medical oncologist at MIA and Royal North Shore Hospital and is chair of melanoma medical oncology and translational research at the University of Sydney. And in case you missed the recent exciting news, Georgina, together with MIA's Professor Richard Scollier, is one of the 2024 Australians of the Year. Welcome to you all, and thank you for coming into the studio today to share your insights with our listeners. Before we dive into the discussion, I just want to take a moment to invite you to join our 2024 Australasian Melanoma Conference, to be held in Sydney in October. Many of the world-leading experts we feature on this podcast series will be presenting at this conference, as it's hosted by Melanoma Institute Australia. To find out more, please visit melanoma2024.com. Sydney, perhaps you could start by telling us a little bit about mucosal melanoma and how it differs from cutaneous melanoma.
Mucosal melanoma is a very rare disease. Unlike cutaneous melanoma, which according to the Cancer Council data of 2019, there were between 15,000 and 16,000 diagnosed in that year, equating to an incidence of about 65 per 100,000. Mucosal melanoma makes up only about 1 to 2% of all melanoma cases. So it's extremely rare. It is more common in patients with pigmented skin. So, for example, in Asians, in Africans, as opposed to cutaneous melanoma, which is more common in Caucasians. Cutaneous melanoma is caused by uncontrolled sun exposure, but that obviously is not the case for mucosal melanoma. There has not been any strong links to the causal effects of any known carcinogens, including viruses. Some of the factors tested in the past include formaldehyde, smoking, as mentioned, some of the carcinogenic viruses, but none of those have actually been established as unequivocal in a link to its etiology. And also, unlike cutaneous melanoma, mucosal melanoma is a lot less responsive to immunotherapy, which has actually changed the landscape enormously of melanoma management. Now, there is a staging system for mucosal melanoma, and of mucosal melanoma, the commonest subtype is obviously in the head and neck. There is a staging system for head and neck mucosal melanoma, but there actually is no staging system for any mucosal melanoma of other body sites. So, Rob, perhaps you can tell us, for this very different entity, talk us through how mucosal melanoma of the head and neck is being staged.
Yeah, thanks, Sydney. So probably most people are aware of the staging system that's available for cutaneous melanoma, which is done through the AJCC staging manual, currently in the 8th edition. And they use the TNM system, which is used for most malignancies we encounter across the body. T being the local invasiveness of the lesion, N being the amount of lymph nodes and where the lymph nodes are involved, and M being any distant metastasis. And as you mentioned, there is a staging system for head and neck mucosal melanomas, and that uses the same system, so T, N, and M. Unfortunately, as you mentioned, it's a very rare disease, and therefore there's not a great deal of data available for us to be able to really tease apart this tumour as well as we can other malignancies, including cutaneous melanoma. So we use the same system, but there's less data points in each system. So for the T system, there's only a T3 and T4. There's no T1 and 2, as we see in most other malignancies. And that goes to show that even very superficial melanomas of the mucosal membranes of the head and neck can be quite aggressive. So the T3 stage is just involvement of the underlying tissues from the mucosa, and T4 is involvement of deeper tissues, deeper to that. Then N and M are very simply N, any lymph nodes involved, yes or no, N0 and N1. And M, any distant metastases, yes or no, M1 or M0. And as you mentioned, there is actually no formal staging system for most other common types of mucosal melanomas, which are either vulvovaginal or anorectal melanomas that we see. And that's why we're obviously collecting data going forward, hoping to get more information about these tumours so we can actually start a staging system for these other kinds of mucosal melanomas. And saying that, hopefully in future, we'll be able to build on the staging system for mucosal melanomas of the head and neck and tease apart different groups so we can understand the prognosis greater and communicate with each other about similar prognostic groups.
And it's tricky as well because for the AJCC's staging system version 7, there is actually a group staging. So there is like the T and M collectively as grouped together for stage 3 versus stage 4, stage 4A and stage 4B. And that was actually abolished in AJCC, the 8th version, because obviously the power of prognostication has not been borne out in the collective TNM staging system.
And that's the problem we face with these rarer tumours, that it's really quite difficult to have a great amount of data points in each of these categories.
So, Georgina, our understanding of cutaneous melanoma has grown in leaps and bounds in the last few decades, shifting our treatment paradigm. However, we have not achieved the same kind of significant advances in mucosal melanoma. So tell us from a medical oncologist perspective, why is this the case, apart from it being rare, and what progress is there currently in this space?
Thanks, Sydney. I think it all goes back down to the fact that cutaneous melanoma and mucosal melanoma are very different entities. They are different cancers, but they share the same name because of the cell of origin, and that's melanoma. They are different. We know this from the last decade, in fact, 2 decades of work we've done, for example, on the genomics of cutaneous melanoma and mucosal melanoma. You mentioned earlier on the causative factors for cutaneous melanoma. It's largely caused by UV radiation or the sun, whereas mucosal melanoma, we don't actually have a handle on the causative factors. And genetically, when we look at the DNA of these two cancers, they are very different. We tend to see higher tumour mutation burden in cutaneous melanoma. So mutations, single nucleotide mutations within the DNA of cutaneous melanoma, whereas in mucosal melanoma, we tend not to see a lot of mutations, or definitely not a high tumour mutation burden, but rather lots of translocations and other sorts of genetic anomalies in that cancer. So from the get-go, they are very different cancers. When it comes to medical oncology and drug therapies, well, of course, this does mean that they are going to respond differently to different types of drug therapies. So in cutaneous melanoma, we've had an absolute huge improvement, in fact, cures in terms of overall survival from advanced cutaneous melanoma and earlier stage cutaneous melanoma due to immune therapies and some BRAF-targeted therapies. We have not seen the same impact in mucosal melanoma. Having said that, though, there are a subset of mucosal melanomas that do respond to these immunotherapies. And we can talk about that a little later. But in general, just to give you that comparison, when we look at our combination immune therapies of checkpoint inhibitors, particularly aimed at what we call PD-1 and CTLA-4, we see about a 60% response in cutaneous melanoma. Conversely, in mucosal melanoma, we see about a 35 to 40% response in that combination. This is for advanced mucosal or advanced cutaneous, just to give you a sense of the difference. The other thing is, in cutaneous melanoma, the responses are durable. So the majority of those 60% are what we think is cured. They're surviving out to now 8, 9, 10 years with no recurrence. Whereas in mucosal melanoma, we do see that those responses are not as durable. So an even smaller subset, what we call cured, there are some, but even smaller than that, 35 to 40%. Where are we heading in the future? We need to think differently about mucosal melanoma. There are many newer immunotherapies emerging that we will be working with mucosal melanoma. Targeted therapies, which we use across cancer, are renowned for not giving us durable responses across any cancer. And we can discuss some of those, what we call targeted therapies. The main difference being targeted therapies kill the cancer cells directly. Immunotherapies activate our immune system in a specific way to kill the cancer cells. So I hope that summarizes where we are, but we are working on mucosal melanoma.
Thank you. And that actually segues very well into my next question to Raven. Surgery is the mainstay of treatment for resectable mucosal melanoma of the head and neck. Can you tell us the approach you have towards mucosal melanoma of the head and neck in endoscopic versus open surgery?
Yeah, sure. And that is true. Ideally, if you can remove this surgically with clear margins, that's going to give us the best result. And I guess the problem is with sinonasal mucosal melanoma.
Which is the commonest.
Which is the most common, that's right. And the most common area is in the nasal cavity as opposed to the sinuses. About 70% are actually in the nasal cavity. It's rare for them to be in the sinuses, which portends a poor prognosis. But the problem with surgery in this area is it's a very expensive real estate. We've got the nose, which is vital, but it's right next to the eye, the brain, the carotid artery, and a whole lot of our upper cranial nerves. And so to get clear margins in this particular pathology where you really do want to take wide margins, it could come at a very, very great cost to the patient in terms of morbidity. The other problem is that up to 41% of these tumours can be amelanotic. And so when you're looking at this tumour with an endoscope, what you see is not necessarily what you get. We might resect it thinking we've taken a huge margin and it's all out, and then we send it off and we get the pathology back with positive margins. The other difficulty with surgery is that frozen sections are notoriously unreliable. With mucosal melanoma, up to a quarter of them you can get a false negative. And the latest recommendations are to not do frozen sections, and particularly not to base a particular surgical decision on a frozen section, because there's a high chance you'll have a false negative result. So we often then need to send it off, wait for the formal histopathology to come back, and then decide whether we take more surgery or look at other treatment options. The benefit of the endoscopic approach is we're using a natural body orifice to remove these tumours, which is much less morbid. It's been shown to have shorter length of stay, and the oncologic results are the same, if not better, than an open approach to these tumours. So there are pros and cons with surgery. The other thing we always have to think about with these tumours is there's a high incidence of satellite metastases or skip metastases. And so even if you think you've got negative margins, you may not. And so we have to think about adjacing the lymph node drainage basin of these tumours, which is traditionally the neck. But unfortunately, if we do address the neck, it's been shown to improve locoregional control, but not overall survival. So it's sort of pros and cons as to how extensive the surgery we do, but it has been shown to be advantageous to, if you can get clear margins, that's going to be giving our patients the best long-term outcomes.
I think the question of open versus endoscopic, quite often the location of the tumour would actually lend itself very well to that decision, you know, apart from the anterior nasal cavity, where it can be very easily approached with a lateral rhinotomy approach. Beyond that, you know, pretty much you need endoscopic approach, or at least endoscopic combined with open approach. And that actually brings me to my next question to Rob. Actually, before that, it's probably a good point to actually state as well, because we haven't initially, that of the head and neck mucosal melanoma, 70% would be in the sinonasal. And of that, the majority would be in the nasal cavity as opposed to the paranasal sinuses. The other 20% is in the oral cavity. And very rarely, we do get head and neck melanoma in the pharynx and larynx. That's like less than 10% of the head and neck mucosal melanomas. So Rob, we heard about endoscopic resection being necessary in many sites. And we also heard that it's very difficult to determine the margin. What are some of the things we surgeons can do to assist in margin assessment?
As a pathologist, I'm very careful not to tell my surgical colleagues what to do and how to do it. But if you give the pathologist, I suppose, more complete specimens, better orientated specimens, we're going to be able to give more definite information and more clear information and more diagnostically important information. So anything I think that the surgeon can do from their part to help guide the pathologist of what and where they're looking at would really be appreciated. Things such as potentially putting the specimen onto a corkboard and labelling it so we know where the margins are and orientating it when necessary. And if there's a particular margin you're interested in, letting us know what and where that margin is really important. I think also when you look at these kinds of melanomas, it's really important to understand the difference from cutaneous melanoma in the fact of how they arise from their overlying in situ melanoma. These melanomas often arise from this really field effect of melanoma in situ rather than the cutaneous melanomas, which have a more definite sort of distinct area of in situ melanoma. Therefore, that I think it makes it more difficult. We've talked about frozen section difficulties. Assessing where the in situ melanoma is in these mucosal melanomas is very, very difficult, particularly on a small biopsy. It's easy when you have the entire specimen with you to sort of see what it looks like in the middle of the lesion compared to what it looks like in the surrounding tissue. So that's just another thing. Assessing the in situ component of these lesions is really difficult for the pathologist. And often we rely on immunohistochemistry to outline sort of where the melanoma in situ might start and stop.
And we heard about how there is a preference for histopathology over frozen section. So what is the shortest turnaround time possible with a histopathology using some of these immunostains that you have mentioned?
That depends on multiple factors. And I suppose the size of the specimen is a big thing. The specimen has to be properly fixed before we can actually look at it down the microscope. And that, from a small biopsy, you know, can be a few hours. To a large resection specimen, it should be an overnight fixation period. So that's sort of one rate-limiting factor. And then from there, it all depends on what you see down the microscope. If it's a simple diagnosis, you can make the report right there and then. If you need immunohistochemistry, that's probably another overnight period that's required. If you need to go back to the specimen, take different blocks, examine it further, take deeper sections, that's all going to add time to it. So you're looking at least generally a few days, to often more, to get a complete, accurate report.
Thank you. So over to you, Angela. What is the evidence for using radiation therapy as a treatment option? Can you take us through incomplete margins? We heard about also field cancerization. Does radiotherapy have a role in head and neck mucosal melanoma in a curative setting, curative and adjuvant setting?
Sure. So in the adjuvant setting, so after surgical resection, the goal of the radiotherapy is to improve the local control because any local recurrence in that region can be quite difficult to manage in terms of further resection, symptoms, and really can affect the quality of life of patient. Because this is a fairly rare disease, there's no high-level evidence in terms of the use of radiotherapy. So we're looking at retrospective series. In fact, there was a systematic review and meta-analysis published in year 2021 of about 2,000 patient mucosal head and neck melanoma. About half had surgery only, half had surgery and radiotherapy. And that showed that adding in radiotherapy after surgery had a benefit in terms of local control with a risk reduction of about 0.63 for the local recurrence rate and also a small benefit in terms of survival with a risk reduction of about 0.93. So definitely a role in terms of improving in the local control after surgical resection. And that's based on the pathology, multiple factors, the margins, whether it's skin metalysis, any field change. So it's a case-by-case discussion at a melanoma MTT setting.
Thank you. I think I'd like to come back to Raywin because I think we sort of touch on the management of the regional nodal basin, but we didn't actually go enough into that. So could you elaborate more on, in a clinically negative neck setting, what is the current approach to the nodal basin in terms of elective neck dissection versus sentinel node biopsy versus lymphoscintigraphy and ongoing surveillance with, for example, high-resolution ultrasound.
So it's actually very different to cutaneous melanoma. If you have a node-negative neck, then we don't touch the neck. As we know, by doing a neck dissection, it doesn't improve overall survival, but if you do have positive lymph nodes, it does improve local control. So if the neck is negative, we leave it alone. Sentinel node biopsy isn't something that's commonly practiced in mucosal melanoma of the head and neck. Similarly with scintigraphy, so it's more surveillance in a node-negative neck. Once you've had surgery and post-operative adjuvant therapy, it's surveillance. And I guess the question is for that is more for Angela and Georgina about, for example, Angela, whether you would cover the neck with radiation or not as well, because we don't prophylactically do a neck dissection in these patients because it's not been shown to improve overall survival.
Yeah, I think increasingly there is evidence that the status of the nodal basin doesn't actually carry a lot of prognostic implications in terms of the outlook from this disease.
And that's what Rob was alluding to as well, and you were alluding to before, the staging system has no prognostic correlation either. So it's a really difficult disease to treat.
On that note, let's bring it over to Georgina. Hopefully we could end it on something that brings hope and promise to this field of treatment of head and neck mucosal melanoma. What is on the horizon?
That's a really good question. I think what is on the horizon for cancer in general, because this is the holy grail, and that is tumours that are not responding to checkpoint inhibitors, so anti-PD-1, anti-CTLA-4 or anti-LAG-3. Anti-LAG-3 is a newer checkpoint that has been examined in melanoma. It's currently being examined in other cancers. And interestingly, in the phase 3 trial of advanced melanoma, there was a subset of about 51 patients with mucosal melanoma, and it showed that there was some activity of the combination of anti-PD-1 and anti-LAG-3. However, it's looking pretty similar to the other combination I mentioned earlier, and that's nivolumab combined with anti-CTLA-4 ipilimumab. And it's not enough patients really to see how much better that may be with compared with anti-PD-1 alone. So the way we are looking at cancer in general that are not considered checkpoint inhibitor very responsive, although I did mention there is a subset that are, is looking for other ways of getting the immune system into the tumour. And one exciting way, for example, is looking at T-cell receptors, synthesized T-cell receptors that bind to T-cells within the body. But at the other end of the molecule, you have one T-cell receptor. At the other end, you have a binder to a specific protein that is, for example, seen in the cancer. So in mucosal melanoma, is there a protein that is common to many that can bring in T-cells by binding to this T-cell receptor and then bringing in T-cells? So that's an area of research right now. We've got many phase 1 clinical trials, and we're hopeful that that may turn some of these less immunogenic tumours being responsive. However, the durability is not yet known about these more novel treatments. Also, we do know that these checkpoint inhibitors can bring in T cells, these are the immune cells of interest, into tumours, even if they don't have an amazing response. And so one area of great interest across cancer, again, is genetically modifying a patient's T cells to make them more effective against their cancer. So that is another area of interest within the cancer field and could be applied to mucosal melanoma. We know neoadjuvant checkpoint immune therapies, combinations of multiple checkpoint immune therapies, may be active in mucosal melanoma, and we have a trial opening shortly for adjuvant combination checkpoint inhibitors.
So is that dual agent, triple agent?
That would be a dual agent. Triple agent has only been explored in melanoma in a phase 1 trial 4 years ago, and we're presenting those results for the first time in 2024. At ASCO, because we're seeing incredible durability of these responses, and that's again in cutaneous melanoma. But that rationale could apply to mucosal melanoma. But the point is, if you can get a short increase in the T cells, extract them out of the tumor, genetically modify them, and infuse them back into the patient, you may be able to overcome that lack of durability with some immune therapies, but stimulate them enough to collect enough at the very get-go. So these are the sorts of things that we're focusing on. And lastly, I would need to mention personalized vaccines, cancer vaccines. There are many different technologies. It's not just mRNA. There are adenoviruses. There's peptide vaccines. There's DNA vaccines. There's a lot of different ways that you may be able to vaccinate a cancer patient against their own tumor. But you first have to have a tumor. So the idea is you take the patient's tumor, you see what's very unique to their tumor by looking at their DNA in the tumor and the RNA in the tumor expression, and you isolate what you think are the most common and immunogenic things expressed, proteins expressed in their tumor, and then you make a vaccine with those proteins to stimulate that patient's immune system against those tumor-related proteins specifically. And it's individualized to an individual patient and their tumor. And that's across cancer is being examined as well and is something that could be applied to mucosal melanoma. The drawback being often these low tumor mutation burden cancers don't have a lot of unique proteins that we can measure easily. But it's still possible. All you need is one to stimulate the immune system. So there are a few key examples of some of the work that's being done. I've focused on immune because so far that has, for across most cancers, that has been our best bet at trying to achieve cures or durable control. But we're working on it.
Can I ask a question?
Of course.
We've spoken about the distinction between cutaneous melanomas and mucosal melanomas. I'd just like to ask you all as clinicians how you go about classifying things on places like the lip and the vulva. Where is it cutaneous or is it a mucosal melanoma? As a pathologist, I'd be very interested to know how you go about doing that, because obviously we've spoken about the treatment implications for that and possibly other management implications.
Conjunctival as well.
Yeah.
That's considered mucosal, but it behaves like cutaneous.
The lip is obviously outside the lip. It gets very high UV damage, and I imagine immunotherapy could be quite active against it, but on the inside of the lip, the opposite.
I can give a medical oncologist view on that, but I'm sure the surgical view is very different because it's all about how you can resect the thing and then radiotherapy as well. But from a medical oncologist viewpoint, I think of the molecular characteristics of the tumour. In fact, I had a patient just this week who had a vulval melanoma, and the advanced trainees, so in training in medical oncology, asked me, do you think of this as a skin or do you think of this as a mucosal? And I always quote your colleague, Richard Scully, who says, well, there's hair down there. Was there hair on the specimen? Then it's cutaneous. However, molecularly, it behaves like mucosal. When we've examined vulval melanomas, they have a lot of translocations, a low tumor mutation burden. Lip, similarly, high tumor mutation burden. So I think of it as a cutaneous. As a drug doctor, I think of it as a cutaneous. Conjunctival, exactly the same. It's very much like a cutaneous melanoma based on the molecular characteristics. So for a drug doctor, it comes down to its molecular characteristics, high tumor mutation burden, translocations, responsiveness to immunotherapy or not. So that's for me. So vulval like mucosal, lip like cutaneous, conjunctival like cutaneous.
I can't quite answer that from a melanoma perspective, but we know that from a, for example, a head and neck cutaneous SCC versus mucosal SCC, we would normally go with increasingly the associated cosmic mutation signature, where it shows that whether it's associated with significant sun damage, for example, and that versus, for example, whether it's a lung primary versus a metastasis. Similarly, I think the mutation signature hopefully would be a pointer towards the etiology.
There is also data that the sinonasal melanomas as a proportion that have a UV signature. So I don't know how that happens, but perhaps reflected or the position of your nose or where your nostrils are. I don't know, but that's an interesting fact to investigate.
I guess the thing you see in sinonasal commonly is when you put the endoscope in, you've got fabulous visualization and you'll see the melanoma itself, but you see this melanosis, like you're talking about that field change. And for me, that's like, where do I stop? I've biopsied it multiple times and it's not melanoma, it's melanosis. But you don't see that in someone without melanoma. So it's this weird field change, but I think with the UV mutational burden, that would be the more anterior septal melanomas. I've not seen that in a paranasal sinus one. Perhaps you have, but I've not seen it in those ones. But, yeah, that's a great question. And I think you don't see the UV mutational burden further in, but you would see it on the lip, the conjunctiva, probably wouldn't see it on the vulva. So, yeah.
This is probably a great time to actually move into a case study. So the case study I've prepared today is a 50-year-old gentleman who has biopsy-confirmed mucosal melanoma of the anterior nasal septum. So this mucosal melanoma has extended from the nasal septum across to the upper lateral nasal cartilage. It's invading into the cartilage and touching or abutting the underlying skin. So, Rob, let's start with you. How would you stage this patient?
Well, you said it's invaded underlying structures. That makes it a T4 stage. And then also, I suppose you need to do imaging, et cetera, to look if there's any other nodal or metastatic disease deposits present. In the pathology report, we will put a whole lot of other information. That's trying to capture further possible prognostic information, things such as thickness, lymphovascular invasion, mitosis, et cetera, just to try to, once again, add to our data in this very rare tumour.
So let's say this is a T4 and not M0 disease. What would be your approach to management, Raywin?
First of all, I want to see how extensive this was, both anteriorly, posteriorly. We know that superiorly it's involving the cartilage and abutting the skin, but how far back does it go? How far down does it go? Is it eroding the hard palate or anything like that? And I would perform endoscopy and also imaging to confirm that, and obviously scans to look for distant disease, and also CT or MRI of the abdomen and pelvis to make sure there's no disease there. But I guess as a surgeon, I'm thinking, how do I get this out with minimal morbidity to the patient? And really that the morbidity cosmetically is how anteriorly it goes and how much of the skin envelope is involved. And what you're describing is something where it sounds like that skin needs to be removed, as well as the underlying cartilage and the disease itself on the mucosa. So I'm sort of, after I've staged them and worked out how extensive this is, I'm trying to work out how I can get it out with maximal margins and minimal morbidity, both cosmetic and functional morbidity to this patient, because where you're describing is a cosmetic location, but it's also a functional location. That's the most narrow part of the nose where they breathe, et cetera. And so you're obviously trying to remove this and still preserve some sort of nasal function as well as cosmesis with this patient.
And the regional nodal basin, would you?
If it was negative on imaging, I would leave it alone.
Yeah, as we have said. Yeah.
So okay. Is that with PET imaging or CT or both?
We would normally do a PET CT imaging as well as an MRI. An MRI, you know, obviously we'll have a brain window as well as a soft tissue window to look at the facial structures. Let's say we remove this, and as you said, you know, we remove this full thickness, so we have reconstructed it. And let's say there is a close margin on the skin somewhere. Is there a role, Angela, do you think, for radiotherapy?
Yeah, with a close margin, I think local control is very important. So I would review the pathology, get all the pathological features and discuss with the patient adjuvant radiotherapy to maximize the local control in that region.
So we have done the surgery, we have done radiotherapy. Is there a role for medical therapy? And reverse it, is there a role for medical therapy to start with before surgery, Georgina?
So in clinical trials, there are trials of what we call neoadjuvant treatments where drug is given for 6 weeks prior to definitive surgery. The surgeon has to be able to put their hand on their heart and say, I can resect this, even with a close margin, that's reasonable, before you could enroll a patient on such a trial. I always like to ask my surgical colleagues, if they don't respond in this 6 weeks, is it still resectable? Because we're talking about the head and neck and it's such a morbid place, as Raywin was mentioning before, all the structures around there. So it's not a place unlike the axillary cutaneous melanoma, for example, where if it gets bigger and more difficult to resect, generally it still can often be resected, but not in the head and neck. It's a danger. It's tiger territory, as people like to say. So there are clinical trials. It is not standardly available. Actually, having said that, pembrolizumab, so single agent anti-PD-1, is now approved for neoadjuvant therapy, but that is mainly based on cutaneous melanoma data. We do not routinely recommend or use adjuvant therapy for stage 3 resected mucosal melanoma because of the efficacy we see in stage 4 is not great with single agent. And it used to be that if we used that now, we were not able to, on the PBS, get combination, which was more effective in mucosal melanoma. That's changed now. So it's got to be discussed at a multidisciplinary team meeting. If it's a patient who can't go on one of our clinical trials, either neoadjuvant or an adjuvant trial, and we have some nice adjuvant trials, then I would be discussing at our MDT whether it's worth giving a dose or two of adjuvant anti-PD-1 in combination, especially with radiotherapy. But we have very low expectations for systemic control. We'd prefer to watch, and then if a patient recurs, then go in with our most effective therapy. I did forget to mention in our conversation before, and this is again for advanced melanoma where it's spread, that we do sometimes use KIT targeted therapy. It's not that frequent in mucosal melanoma, but it's, you know, it's in the sort of 15 to 20% mark for a KIT mutation, not an amplification, particularly in exon 11 and 13. They can be responsive to targeted therapies, but it's short, durable response. It's not a cure. And then the other one is BRAF. We do occasionally see a BRAF mutation, about 10% of mucosal melanoma, and we can use BRAF-targeted therapies in advanced setting. But in this, back to the case, the patient's had a resection. They're going to have radiotherapy. We would probably just observe. Or if we had a clinical trial, try and get them on the neoadjuvant clinical trial. If the surgeons think that it would remain resectable in 6 weeks, we do closely monitor, though, or an adjuvant trial after resection.
So just to recap, I think some of the key points that have come up in today's discussion, we know that mucosal melanoma is a very different disease as compared to cutaneous melanoma. Mucosal melanoma is commonest in the head and neck region. And in this head and neck region, it is commonest in the nasal cavity and paranasal sinuses. That makes up about 70%, followed by the oral cavity, 20%. And the remainder would be in the pharynx and the larynx when we talk about head and neck mucosal melanoma. Obviously, there are some of the other variants as well, like conjunctival melanoma. The etiology for mucosal melanoma is obviously very different. It's not due to uncontrolled sun exposure as it is for cutaneous melanoma. The staging system currently is very rudimentary, for the lack of a better word, because of the rarity of the disease. So currently for AJCC8, head and neck mucosal melanoma staging, there isn't a group staging, so we don't have a stage 3 or stage 4. What we do have is T3, where it is localized to the mucosa and the immediate underlying tissue, T4A, where it has invaded a bit deeper, and T4B, where it's actually involved major structures and major nerves going towards the skull base. We have N1, where there's positive lymph node, and M1, where there is evidence of metastasis. The surgery combination of open versus endoscopic surgery or individually is currently the mainstay of treatment. And the goal is obviously to get clear margins because there has been shown to actually improve prognosis for the disease. But at this stage, increasingly, the evidence is that the nodal status is not really that important in the overall picture. So we don't actually address a negative neck electively. So there is no role for elective neck dissection, no role for sentinel node biopsy or lymphoscintigraphy for mapping of the sentinel nodes. Radiotherapy is important for local control because, again, in the head and neck region, it is such a morbid region if the disease is out of control, even if it means that there is no impact on the overall survival. And we heard that hopefully we're going to have major advances in medical therapy. Currently, the regime that has got the biggest role would be dual agent therapy. So most commonly, that would be anti-PD-1. So for example, nivolumab combined with anti-CTLA-4, ipilimumab, or substituting the anti-CTLA-4 with anti-LAG-3. Now, things in the horizon will be modification of the T cells and personalized vaccine. I would like to thank our panelists today. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule. Have a good day.
Thanks, Sydney, Georgina, Angela, Robin, Raywin, for providing your insight around head and neck mucosal melanoma. MIA has developed a patient information brochure on mucosal melanoma that's available to download in English, simplified Chinese and Arabic. Please download it for your patients at melanoma.org.au and feel free to share it around. Also, just a note that Melanoma Patients Australia run a specific mucosal melanoma support group in addition to its other support programs for people affected by melanoma. You can find out more at melanomapatients.org.au or via the national support line on 1300 884 450. You have been listening to Melanoma Insights for Professionals, brought to you by Melanoma Institute Australia and made possible by unrestricted educational grants from Merck Sharp & Dohme Pharmaceuticals, Bristol Myers Squibb and Heine. I'd also like to acknowledge that this recording was done on Cammeraygal land. Please note that this podcast was accurate at the time of recording, March 2024, but may not reflect the rapidly evolving treatment landscape and approvals in Australia. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please share it with a colleague or friend and be sure to leave us a review. For more practice-changing education, sign up to our Melanoma Education portal at melanomaeducation.org.au. Thanks for listening.